Appreciate you being out again this afternoon so we can study God's Word together. If you remember back to whenever we met last time on Sunday night, we've had a couple of weeks where we've been not meeting or for one reason or another, and we were talking in Mark chapter 13. And we got about halfway through there. As you read it over in Mark chapter 13, you realize that we kind of need to do a little bit of review to see where we have been, so we can catch up to where we are. And where we are is around verse 14 of Mark chapter 13. So what I want to do to begin with is just kind of briefly review what we've talked about. If you remember in Mark chapter 13, Jesus is and his disciples are leaving the temple area where Jesus had just been in conflict, debate, with the religious leaders, and they kept asking questions, trying to pin him down or trying to trap him, and he defeated them all, and in the end they would not venture to ask him any more questions. And we get down to chapter 13, verse 1 says, as they were going out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, behold what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." And then Jesus responded in an unusual way. We talked about how wonderful the temple was, how beautiful it was, just almost like one of the seven wonders of the world. And Jesus just simply said, "You see these buildings? Not one stone will be left upon another, which will not be torn down." And that is a very pointed, direct promise or prophecy of the destruction of Jerusalem, the temple in this particular case. And so they traveled down from the temple area across the Kidron Valley up to the Mount of Olives. And the Bible says that Peter, James, and John and Andrew were there. And they began to ask him questions. Now, Mark has this question. Tell us, when will these things be and what will be the sign when all these things are going to be fulfilled? Now, Matthew's account adds a little different wording to make it sound like they're not only asking about that, but they're also asking about the end of time, when Jesus is going to come again. And it could be that in their minds they're thinking the two are virtually the same. If Jerusalem destroyed, that's the end of everything. Anyway, they're asking a couple of different questions there. And as we got into our studies last week and looking at that, we began looking at some signs of the coming destruction of Jerusalem. Now, I might mention these very briefly, but it's about seven signs. Jesus began to say, "See to it that no man misleads you." And he talks about those who claim to be the Christ. After Jesus' death, after his resurrection, there were those who claimed to be the Messiah, the second coming, and they would lead people away. We mentioned last time several specific groups that did that in secular history. Acts chapter 5 or so mentioned some that did it, that Gamaliel mentioned as he was talking about the disciples and whether or not to put them to death. A second sign is that there would be wars and rumors of wars. That's verses 7 and 8. And at this period of time, we find the world was in a real state of conflict. The Romans government in Rome, but also in Palestine. In Palestine, you had the religious zealots who are always doing something to counteract the Romans, and actually the destruction of Jerusalem was a direct response to them, as they had done so many things to rebel against Rome. But even back in Rome, there were a lot of things going on. There was emperors rising to power and falling. There was one year that was called the year of four emperors, because they had four different people on the throne. So there was a rapid changes that followed Nero's suicide. The third sign, earthquakes and famines, natural disasters, in verse 8 in particular. And then the fourth sign, the persecution of Christians. He says, "Be on your guard, for they will deliver you to the courts, and you'll be flogged in the synagogues, and you'll stand before governors and kings for my sake, as a testimony to them." The fulfillment of that is seen in the ministry of the Apostle Paul. We see it with Peter. We see it with James being beheaded by the King Herod. All through this period, the apostles were told, don't worry about what you say. You're going to be called before kings and people in high places. The Spirit will give you what to say on those occasions. So the testimony was given far and wide concerning that. But yet, these are just preliminary things leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem. And then in verse 10 and verse 11, the fifth sign is that the gospel must be preached to all the nations. Colossians 1:23 says that it was. Other places in Romans suggest the same thing. Before 70 AD, the early church had preached the gospel under all creation. That's an amazing accomplishment, but that's what they were able to do. And Jesus said that's going to happen before the destruction of Jerusalem. Colossians written in the 60s, so you're getting right up close to the time of the destruction of Jerusalem. A sixth sign that we mentioned is that families would be divided over Christ. A brother will betray brother to death, father his child, children rise up against their parents and have them put to death, and says, you will be hated by all because of my name, but the one who endures to the end will be saved. This is a period, a very difficult time, and you can see that some persecution went on at that time. And then the seventh sign we mentioned also is, we just say the abomination of desolation. That's an interesting term. We talked about it a little bit last time. Just refer you to the book of Daniel for some of that, because there is some of that. And we might suggest the possibility that some of this might have had to do with the Roman armies coming in, standing where they didn't belong, in the temple or around Jerusalem. And so these are the things that he warns them about, are signs that this is happening. Actually, one thing I'll mention, and that is this, that when the armies came in, I think Vespasian was one of the guys, that they came in, they conquered Judea and Perea and some of those areas, and actually came and surrounded Jerusalem and other places, besieged them, I guess you would say. And then the news came back of some things happening over in Rome, some wars and things going over there, and the army withdrew very temporarily. They got things straightened out and they came back. But the Christians who were aware of what Jesus said left Jerusalem, and they were there no longer. They weren't there anymore. They had fled from Jerusalem and maybe to the caves or some other place, but they were not in the city when it was finally besieged by Titus and the city was taken. So now we're ready to get into verse 14 now. I know we went kind of fast on that, but to get this done, we need to jump to where we are. Verse 14 begins what we might call a series of admonitions. Because all these things are going to happen, the first thing that Jesus admonished them was to flee to the mountains. The end of verse 14 says, those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. Flee to the mountains. Now, that's interesting. You know, sometimes in the Bible, you'll have a statement, statements that indicate you just hold on, you endure, you withstand, but you don't flee. But there is a time to flee. In this case, when they knew this was happening, the loyalty of the Christian citizens, Christian Jews, having been converted to Christ, their loyalty was not in the temple any longer. And so leaving made sense. And so they followed the words of Jesus and fled. About 1.1 million people died in the Jerusalem besiegement and being conquered by Rome, according to Josephus anyway. About 97,000 were taken into slavery. So this is a very traumatic thing. And one of the great events in world history, and some of the symbolism and some of the apocalyptic language that follows is there for that reason. So he says to flee. And And we're talking here about the end of Jerusalem. And the early verses here, he's not talking about the end of the world. Sometimes people will get into Mark chapter 13 and Matthew chapter 24, and they'll be kind of like picking and choosing. This is about the end times. You need to follow it through, and I think what you'll find is that it does fit the destruction of Jerusalem up to a point. And then up to a point, you have to decide whether he's talking about the second coming. Okay, now the second admonition is the urgency of their flight. Verses 15 and 16. And we read, "And one who is on the housetop must not go down or go to get anything out of his house, but the one who is in the field must not turn back to get his coat." In other words, when he's talking about flee, he means flee immediately. And it may be, we don't know all the situation of what was back then, but the urgency of all of this. If you're on the housetop, don't go back down. Now you think, what does that mean? I mean, these people up there putting new shingles on the roof, or what are they doing? Well, we know the housetops that they had back then were flat. They were places where the people went up to take a nap or to do meditation or to have family activities. We read about some rooftops in the Gospels where some people brought a man who was, they carried a man in a pallet up onto the roof. Well, this is in agreement with the fact that on the outside of the houses there'd be staircases up to the roof. In order to get down, you had to go down the staircase, get up, get on it. And they went up to the top, removed some of the tiles, and let the man down in front of Jesus. So these were houses, very likely pressed together, not big yards or anything. And so one house next to another, it would make sense then, rather than go down the stairs, just head for the hills. One housetop to the next, to the next, to the next. And then when you get down, head out. So the language is not specifically applied to everyone, but the idea is get out of town. Get out of town when you have a chance. Okay? And he also goes on to say that the same kind of figure, if you're working in the field, don't get your coat, don't get your blanket. Just immediately leave. And the faithful Christians who listened got out of town and were spared. Another admonition we have in verses 17 and 18. "But what are those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days? But pray that this will not happen in the winter." Just another statement that Jesus made about circumstances in life that would make it more difficult to flee. And so pray that you may, the women may not be pregnant or nursing, which would make it more difficult to get out of Jerusalem. There's a statement made in Luke chapter 23, 28 and 29. It says, Jesus is on his way to the cross. Simon is employed to carry the cross because Jesus fell beneath its weight. And Jesus, it says in verse 27, following him was a large crowd of people and of women who were mourning and lamenting him. But Jesus turned to them and said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, stop weeping for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, 'Blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bore and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall upon us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.'" It may not be a reference to the destruction of Jerusalem, but there's coming a day, Jesus said, when something bad's going to happen. And it seems like maybe that may reference a situation like what we're talking about. "Pray that it may not be in winter." Again, that's a hardship. In the winter was their rains. It rained a lot. There's flooding on the rivers. So pray that it might not be there. And Matthew adds, "Pray that it not be on the Sabbath day." Admonition number four, the reason for the flight, verse 19, for those days will be a time of tribulation such as not occurred since the beginning of creation, which God created until now and never will. And thus the Lord has shortened those days. No life would have been saved, but for the sake of the elect whom he chose, he shortened the days. Some people read this, and they see the word tribulation, and they have a doctrine of 7 years of tribulation before the end of time, before Christ takes his kingdom on earth and all of that, the premillennial stuff. And they say, well, that's talking about this. No, you can't jump that. You can't jump ship like that. You've got to stay in the context. This is a context of tribulation connected with the destruction of Jerusalem, not the end of the world. But you look at this and you just notice certain statements in there. One, for example, is that unless the Lord has shortened those days, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect whom he chose, he shortened the days. The days of what? Of tribulation in connection with of Jerusalem. You think about all those people in that city. Josephus writes a lot about that, and if you want to get into that, it's very gross, actually, a very bad thing that happened, you know, concerning cannibalism and things like that. But you have the destruction of Jerusalem, besieged as it was, and the duration of it, according to, I think, maybe it's Josephus, maybe some other writer, 5 months. 5 months encircled. Okay. When they got in there and started executing people, yes, there would be a lot of people hanging from crosses or killed or whatever way they could do it. So a lot of people were killed in that destruction. And yet 5 months, he says, was for the sake of the elect. The days were shortened. Sometimes a siege would last a year or more. Jerusalem had the ability, since the days of Hezekiah, I believe, to have water come into the city through some springs that were Hezekiah's tunnel under the city. So they had the water. The food was scarce, no doubt. And people were starving. And when he says the days were shortened, for the sake of the elect, it reminds me of the people who had escaped and who had people they knew back in the city. You know that these Christians were praying for them, and that in answer to prayer, God made it a shorter period of time of suffering. You say, well, that makes sense. At least that's kind of what I was thinking anyway. Okay. Let's go to the next point. Admonition number five. The deterrence to the flight. Things that got in the way for them to leave. Verses 21 and 22. And if anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ, or behold, he is there, do not believe him, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show signs and wonders in order to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. This is something that it's hard for us because the Bible doesn't talk about this so much. Only that it happened. But after Jesus died and rose again, and he promised to come back again, there was a series of false prophets asking people to believe in them. It's interesting that sometimes a rather large crowd of people would follow someone out into the wilderness. And in Acts chapter 5, Gamaliel said, you know, this had happened, and each one of those was taken care of in their time. So leave the Christians alone. Leave these men alone. So this admonition, these deterrents of false teaching, was to precede the end of Jerusalem. And history records that, a number of false Christs. And then number six, the admonition, the final admonition, verse 23 says, but take heed, I have told you everything in advance. So Jesus is preparing the disciples for that future event, the end of Jerusalem. Now, for us today, because we don't live in the first century. We're not Jews. It's hard for us to imagine the enormous event, the weight of that event on not only the Jewish people but on the world. The Jerusalem being destroyed. It had been there for many, many, many years. It had been strong in the days of Solomon and David, and it had continued for a long time. And eventually, the temple was destroyed, and they were taken into captivity. And the Jews came back from Babylon, and they built the temple up again. Now, that temple was not so significant as far as size or beauty, but Herod the Great had worked on this temple. In the days of Christ, he had been working on it for 40 years, adding this and adding that. Never once did they close it for worship. They worked around those kinds of things, and the temple became bigger and brighter and more beautiful all the time. And the work continued up until the early 60s, after the time of Christ, continued to be built up. And so by the time Jerusalem is destroyed, you know, these people took a lot of confidence from the fact that God's temple is in our city. You see that? They did in the old days. In the days of Jeremiah, their answer to the prophets who said, "You're going to be destroyed. It's time to repent." They would say, "The temple, the temple, the temple. God lives here. Can't you see? This is the temple over here. Their trust is in the temple." And the fact of the matter is, they always had that to look back on. You could see it for miles. From Mount of Olives, it looked, I'm sure it had a good view of the temple. But back then, God dealt with them, and Jerusalem was destroyed, and the temple was destroyed. But now, they're even more so ingrained in this idea of the temple and its beauty. And Jesus says, not one stone is going to be left upon another. God is doing away with the Jewish economy. The record of the genealogical records of the Jews would be gone. There would be no place for them to offer their animal sacrifices. Temple worship was a thing of the past. This is evidence that that system is gone, and that the system of Christ, the system of faith, following Jesus through his word, is now in effect. Okay. Now let's go on. Talk about a division here. And when you get into this chapter, there are some people who take everything in this chapter to be the destruction of Jerusalem. But there's some language that might indicate that because the two events, the second coming and the destruction of Jerusalem, have some parallels, you might read Matthew to see what these parallels are, that he also would bring in word about the second coming. And so this could be in reference to the second coming of Christ. Verses 24 through 27. But in those days after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers that are in the heavens will be shaken. Let me pause a moment here. You know, when the Bible says things like the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, or the moon will become as blood, or the stars falling from the heavens, those kind of statements are made as figurative descriptions of great events, not taken literally. Not taken literally. Go to Acts chapter 2. These men speaking in tongues they had never had heard of before. And Peter there, his sermon is recorded, if you remember. And Peter quotes from Joel, the prophet, "It shall be in the last days, I'll pour forth my spirit on all nations, and your sons and daughters will prophesy, and your young men will see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams," and so forth. And go down to verse 19. "And I will grant wonders in the sky above, and on the signs on the earth below, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and glorious day of the Lord." Prophecy was like that. They would bring in the symbolic language to demonstrate the power of that event. So when he says that, that's not necessarily talking physically. That's going to happen. But it's a great event. And if he's talking about the end of the world, how would you describe it? Anyway, he goes on to say, then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. And then he will send forth the angels and will gather together his elect from the four winds, from the farthest end of the earth to the farthest end of heaven. Like I said, some people take even that to apply to the destruction of Jerusalem. And they have some good arguments. But the thing that is hard to get out of is this statement, the Son of Man will be coming with clouds and great power and glory. That's hard to take that in reference to the coming of Jerusalem. But you can, in the sense that the Lord is coming, they would say, the Lord is coming in judgment. And they see the whole thing with Rome being a symbolic judgment that the Son of Man is bringing about. I don't necessarily take it that way. But it does seem to be a transition from the end of Jerusalem, destruction of Jerusalem, which reminds us about the second coming of Christ. But he says in verses 24 and 25, but in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers that are in the heavens will be shaken. If you go through this passage, and you look for those contrasting conjunctions, but in those days, often in the scriptures when you're doing a prophecy, in those days refers to a time in the future, something not presently happening, but something that will happen later. In those days, Mark uses that, and Matthew does it even better. He talks about all this, but he says, but in that day, talking about the second coming, which was a question that they had asked as well then. You'll see the Son of Man coming with the clouds. And some of the Old Testament scriptures go along with that. At the end time, we read that statement, he will send forth the angels and will gather them, his elect, from the four winds, from the farthest end of the earth to the other. I believe he's talking here about the time when Christ comes. There's going to be a gathering. The angels are going to be gathering together the elect from every nation, Christians. And that gathering would be something that we would be looking forward to. That's a positive side. Matthew 24:30 deals with the negative side. He says, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn. You can see how that could apply to Jerusalem. Could also apply to the second coming. There's another statement here in Mark 13. And beginning in verse 28. And he seems like he's flipping back to talking about the destruction of Jerusalem again. If he's ever left that subject, he may be going back to it now. He says, but of that day, verse 32, but of that day and hour, no one knows. Not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. Does that give you an idea here of what he's talking about? But of that day, no one knows. But in Matthew 24, Jesus said about the same thing. No one knows when Christ is coming, that's the second time. No one. Not even the Son. And so he says the same thing basically here. He says, no one knows that, but take heed, keep on the alert, for you do not know when the appointed time will come. It's like a man away on a journey who upon leaving his house, I skipped down to the wrong thing here. I should be up in Mark 13:28. I missed that. Mark 13:28 is where I wanted to be. Okay, you got that? He talks about a parable of a fig tree. And he says, when its branch has already become tender, puts forth its leaves, and when it does, you know that summer is near. Even so, you too, when you see these things happening, recognize that he is near, right at the door. Truly I say to you, notice this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. I think the thing that the parable of the fig tree seems to be talking about that generation, because he says, this generation will not pass away till these things come. You can see these signs, evidence that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. And what he says there is going to happen in this generation. And then we get to what I was talking about earlier, where I slipped my place there. But of that day and hour, no one. Matthew's a little bit clearer on that. He talks about the destruction of Jerusalem. And then around verse 35, I think it is, somewhere around there, he says, but of that day. So you're talking about one subject, the destruction of Jerusalem, which in many ways has some parallels to the end of time. But then he says, but of that hour, but of that day, he's addressing another question. And I believe he's answering the question about the coming of the Lord. And then he makes this statement about a man going on a journey, upon leaving his house, putting his slaves in charge, assigning to each one his task, also commanded the doorkeeper to stay on the alert. Therefore, be on the alert, for you do not know when the master of the house is coming, whether in the evening, at midnight, or when the rooster crows, or in the morning, in case it should come suddenly and find you asleep. What I say to you, I say to all, be on the alert. That pretty much ends the chapter. So, as we think about it, two subjects here, and the hard thing to decide is this particular verse talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, or has he moved on to talking about the second coming? Do you remember in Matthew 24 anything that Jesus said that would, as he described the end of time? He didn't know. He did mention some things that happened in the days of Noah. Remember that? Be eating and drinking, giving and taking in marriage. The whole point he makes in Matthew is that if everything will be business as usual, everything will be normal. We don't know the day or the hour, but it's going to happen. The difference between the second coming and the destruction of Jerusalem is that by the grace of God, Christ prophesied certain things to watch out for. And when these things began to happen, you stay alert and you'd be ready to flee to the mountains. And apparently they understood it better than we do, I think, because for all we know, every Christian got out of there. And God spared their lives. Okay, any comments or thoughts at this time? I know I went kind of fast. Yes. Yes. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, good point. And yes, that's the case. Josephus mentions it, some other, Eusebius, I think, was another one. But there was a reprieve. When you see the abomination of desolation standing in the temple, that's the desecration of the city by the Romans. Even prior to that, I think they talk about vultures or the symbol of Rome coming in to get out of town. In other words, the army, their flag coming in, was a problem. Anything else? It's interesting to me that Jesus spent this time teaching, and over again he would talk about his kingdom not being of this world. He's coming to die, be crucified, and then he'll rise again from the grave. His kingdom would be established, but his kingdom is not on earth. He ascended unto the Father to take the right hand of the throne of God, where he reigns as Lord of Lords and King of Kings. He will never, ever set foot on the earth again. Never. It's not going to happen. That's a theory that men have made by abusing certain passages of Scripture. Because when Jesus comes again, 2 Peter says something's going to happen to the earth. You remember what that was? It will be destroyed. The earth and its works will be burned up. The elements will melt with intense heat. The physical universe will pass out of existence. Christ, however, will continue to reign over his people. So at that point, we're no longer in an earthly kingdom. We have gone on to the next phase of our existence, to be with God forever and ever. Okay. Excellent point, Mike. The disciples themselves still struggled with that question after the resurrection, before the ascension. Lord, will you not restore your kingdom to Israel? They were saying, are we going to do it now? They still didn't understand it at that point. And even after the resurrection, there were people who gladly would fill the role of being the promised Messiah, but they were false teachers. And they had nothing behind their teaching. They would lead people astray. So you're right, there was that false teaching. And Jesus said that's one sign that we're getting ready for the destruction of Jerusalem. It's connected with Jerusalem being destroyed. When Jerusalem is destroyed, then the understanding of a promised Messiah and all of that began to fade. Why? Because they could not connect anyone legitimately to the Christ, legitimately to be a son of David, because all the genealogical records were gone, burned up. So that's the way it is. We'll stop there, and we'll have an opportunity with this song that we're singing. If you have a prayer request or would like us to pray with you or meet any spiritual need that you have, we want to invite you to come while we stand and sing.